Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, great job, everybody. The Commerce Department says consumer spending shot up last month, so thanks for doing your part to help the economy keep chugging along. Of course, I joke we're only spending more because prices are going up for food, and oh yeah, for energy too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 1st of May. Good to have you here. When the Federal Reserve cut rates yesterday, you got the feeling they did it grudgingly, almost because it was expected or something. The statement they issued along with the cut explained why they are still worried about inflation, and it appears with good cause. The Commerce Department's number on consumer spending this morning was double expectations, but only because food and energy prices are where they are. One of the beneficiaries of those higher energy prices reported profits this morning. ExxonMobil cleared a tidy $10.9 billion last quarter. But in the way that only Wall Street can, traders saw that as bad news. Exxon shares fell more than 3.5% today. Because even though big oil's prospects look good at the wellhead, they've mostly evaporated by the time consumers pull up to the corner gas station. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
In a way, ExxonMobil and the other big gasoline producers are paying the price. Every time you put the nozzle back on the pump, rip off your receipt, and find yourself grumbling that at that price they can keep their blankety-blank gasoline. Refineries are getting the message. While their raw material costs 70% more than a year ago, pump prices are up just 33%. Tom Closa is chief analyst for the Oil Price Information Service.
Once you leave the wellhead, and this is the difference between this year and other years, it gets miserable as you move through the system. Refiners are making what would be regarded as very poor margins compared to 2003 to 2007.
They're struggling to pass on their costs. Stephen Shork heads the research firm Energy Market Intelligence.
They can only sell what the market is willing to bear, and the market in gasoline and diesel fuel simply is not willing to bear the price that Exxon and so forth have to pay for the crude oil, and hence contraction in these profit margins.
Just this week, North America's biggest refiner, Valero, blamed the squeeze for a 77% profit plunge. The refiners are charging more to make up the difference, never mind that that violates the law of supply and demand. Shork says crude oil is essentially backed up in the U.S. pipelines, and analyst Tom Closa expects consumers to keep pushing back.
The tipping point has always been 325. In places where we're above 350 and 375 right now, I think we're going to see some real demand destruction out there among the population.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Oil actually fell today, by the way, quite a bit, too, down to $112.52 a barrel. It was mostly a dollar story as the greenback continues its rise against the euro. With food commodity prices holding near record levels, some big rice-growing countries are taking a page from the global oil markets. They're thinking of something along the lines of OPEC, only for rice. Thailand, the world's biggest rice producer, is behind the idea. We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler whether a food cartel could actually work.
The skyrocketing price of rice is already sparking protests in poor countries around the world. And a cartel that keeps prices artificially high is unlikely to sit well with rice importers like the Philippines and Bangladesh, where many people live on less than a dollar a day. Eric Wales is a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Arkansas.
Raising the price of rice, which is their staple food, would, I think, be considered in many quarters as immoral and unethical.
Ethics questions aside, Whale says a cartel might be able to keep prices high, but only in the short term.
And it would be untenable, I think, in the longer run.
A rice cartel would not be like OPEC for the simple reason that oil is a finite resource. If non-cartel nations see an economic benefit, they can plant more rice. The U.S., already the world's fourth largest rice producer, hasn't been invited into the cartel, and that may be an advantage.
If the cartel were to be formed and did not encompass the United States, then the United States could potentially benefit from the effects of the cartel.
That's Thomas Wynn with the U.S. Rice Producers Association. If the cartel raised prices too high, U.S. rice would begin to look more attractive.
It could potentially mean additional markets. More than likely, it would mean an increase in price for the U.S. farmers.
Thailand has floated the idea of a rice cartel for years. Now, with prices hovering near record highs, it might get off the ground. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
At the White House this afternoon, President Bush asked Congress for $750 million in emergency food aid. No details yet, though, on how that's going to be spent. Let me take this opportunity to introduce what might be the brightest spot in a shaky global economy. Earlier this year, Brazil went from being one of the world's worst debtor nations to having a positive balance due. It's kept inflation under control, too. And this week, Standard & Poor's gave it a long-sought-after investment-grade credit rating. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
In Brazil, the new rating got the kind of attention usually reserved for the national soccer team. The Eurasia Group's Christopher Garman.
The president highlighted this being a magical moment. It received a lot of play in Brazil's nightly news. It was headline news in most of Brazilian newspapers.
Brazil's stock market hit a record high. Bond yields dipped to a record low. But why all the hullabaloo over a credit rating? Reardon Roed is with Johns Hopkins University. He says many mutual funds and pension funds are barred from investing in junk status bonds. The transition to investment grade will translate to a flood of cash.
Hundreds of millions to billions of dollars over the next 3 to 6 months as portfolio managers realign their portfolios, making space for more exposure to Brazil.
Analyst Lisa Schneller is with Standard & Poor's, the rating agency that upgraded Brazil. She says Brazil's turnaround spanned both conservative and leftist administrations.
The key thing that Brazil has is a sound policy framework that has withstood political transition.
She says Brazil still faces many fiscal challenges, including a high level of internal government debt.
There are many more rating levels between BBB minus and AAA, and I think the incentive is to keep on moving up the rating scale.
She says a high credit rating creates a virtuous cycle. The more money that flows into Brazil, the greater the motivation to keep the country on a sound fiscal path. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Wall Street was pretty enthusiastic today. The Dow closed above 13,000. The NASDAQ and the S&P did fine, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Department of Agriculture says U.S. farm profits this year are going to be well above average, thanks in large part to the explosion in food commodity prices. But commentator and journalist Bill McConnell says farmers know better than to get too excited about a short-term windfall.
These should be heady times in America's agricultural business. Global demand for corn, wheat, and other crops is at historic highs. A combination of factors is stoking this boom. Food consumption in rapidly developing nations like China and India is on the rise. The use of corn and soybean-derived fuels has increased U.S. demand for commodities. On top of that, the weak dollar makes American ag exports more affordable overseas. Despite all that, a sense of foreboding hangs over the business. Farmers, their distributors, and their bankers have seen booms before, and they know the good times often end with a crash. The go-go farm economy could be the next financial bubble. Indeed, agriculture experts say today's boom is built on a fragile confluence of factors that could upend the sector suddenly. Demand for corn could plummet if it loses political favor as a feedstock for ethanol. The ethanol craze is now being blamed for food shortages in poor countries. Oil prices could significantly outpace crop prices, and this could increase the cost of inputs like fuel and fertilizer and cut farmers' revenues. A collapse of farm profits would hit the banks in American farm states. Many farmers have been borrowing to expand their land holdings and are paying record prices. The flush farm economy also has attracted Wall Street firms looking for double-digit returns. Ag experts see investment funds' participation from the likes of Morgan Stanley and BlackRock as a double-edged sword. They provide liquidity, but they can exit the market as quickly as they entered. The increases in land values and the borrowing that feeds it worries officials in the Midwest. Adding to their anxiety is the erosion of manufacturing in the region. When the farm economy crashed 2 decades ago, many farmers weathered the storm by taking second jobs in nearby factories. Today, those jobs aren't there. One farmer told me, "We know our land is not an entitlement. We don't take for granted it's something we can't lose."
Bill McConnell is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Deal. That's a magazine that covers mergers and investment banking. We'd love to hear from you about the food crisis or anything else that's on your mind. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says Contact. Bank stocks were up big today. Merrill Lynch and Citigroup looked particularly tasty. They got a bump after Kuwait's sovereign wealth fund said it might be interested in snapping up a bigger share in both firms. Citi raised a bunch of money earlier this week by selling off some new stocks. Still, though, it probably won't turn up its nose at Kuwait's cash because Citigroup's just one of the big banks working hard to reduce what folks on Wall Street call leverage. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains why that's so.
Anyone who's bought a home knows the power of leverage. Let's say I want to buy a $300,000 house. All I need is maybe $30,000 of my own money. That's my equity. I'd be putting 10% down. I can get a mortgage to cover the rest. That's leverage, the use of borrowed money to increase gains. Richard Silla teaches financial history at New York University's Stern School of Business. He says leverage is great as long as home prices are going up. With that 10% down payment, if the price of my house rises just 10%, I've doubled my money. But if it falls 10%, Silla says, my equity's gone.
So you magnify your gains or returns, and you magnify your possible losses when you have leverage, because the money borrowed, you have to pay back no matter whether the price of what you buy goes up or down.
Just as homeowners put less and less money down during the housing boom, financial institutions also boosted their leverage.
What we're looking at is we're looking at the leverage ratios of the brokerage firms, right?
Brad Hintz walks me through the finer points of leverage on his computer. He's a securities industry analyst with Sanford Bernstein. A chart shows that 5 years ago, the big brokerage firms borrowed about $21 for every real dollar they held on their books. By the beginning of this year, they were borrowing more than $30 for every dollar of equity. That's like me putting less than $10,000 down to buy that $300,000 house. Only because a lot of the brokerage firm's debt is short-term, Hintz says it's a bit like me buying my house with a credit card.
If you financed your house with a MasterCard, and the MasterCard company sent you a notice saying, we want all of our money back tomorrow, what price would you get for your house? Well, not a very good price, right? That was fundamentally what happened to Bear Stearns.
Hintz says when Bear Stearns' lenders and investors wanted their money back, the firm couldn't sell assets fast enough to pay them. So how did banks like Bear let their borrowing get so out of hand? Anil Kashyap teaches finance at the University of Chicago Business School. He says just like in the housing market, when returns were good, taking on more and more leverage didn't seem that risky. And no one wanted to miss out on the party.
Because when you're being cautious, the other guys are using their equity more efficiently than you are. They're earning more money, getting higher bonuses. You know, it's very difficult to be the grumpy guy that keeps insisting on watching out for some problem that's yet to materialize.
But shouldn't the government have been that grumpy guy? Kashyap says all that leverage was fueling the boom in home ownership. He says regulators were reluctant to interfere.
Now, what would that have got spun as? It would have said, well, there's all these, often low-income borrowers who would like credit, but the government's telling us we can't give it to them.
Of course, now everyone's grumpy. Regulators look likely to clamp down on how much investment banks can borrow. Banks themselves are working to reduce their leverage. Citigroup raised $4.5 billion yesterday by selling stock. Lehman Brothers recently raised $4 billion. It wants to boost its capital reserves and reassure investors it won't be another Bear Stearns. But Kashyap says there's a downside to deleveraging. He says institutions less willing to take on risk will be less likely to lend money. And that credit crunch we're hearing so much about could get a lot worse. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, looking for a license to drive in Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's a big problem for me. I get a job and I said, no, sorry, I can't start now.
So you got a job offer and you had to turn it down?
Yeah, I'm turning it because nothing to do. I cannot move.
But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market rallied to its highest level since the start of the year. Today, the Dow Industrials paraded 189 points higher, nearly 1.5%. Topped out at 13,010. The NASDAQ was boosted by a wave of bargain hunting for tech stocks. It climbed 67 points. That is 2.8%, wrapping up at 2480. The S&P 500 gained 23 points, 1.7%, closed at 1409. Freddie Mac finished up by almost 7.5% today. Fannie Mae jumped more than 5% higher. Bank of America in the money by nearly 5%. Citigroup and Goldman Sachs both picked up around 4%. Here's one significant indicator that things may be looking up for financials. The Federal Reserve reports big Wall Street investment firms have pulled back from using the Fed's emergency lending program. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By the Society for Human Resource Management, HR. Leading people, leading organizations. Online at shrm.org. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper. The cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
The Marketplace date book. Here's a look at events coming up Friday. Oil and gas companies hope to keep pumping out profits as Chevron reports its first quarter earnings. Looking for work? These are the numbers to watch. The Labor Department releases jobs data. And the calendar may say May, but it's summertime in Hollywood. The film industry kicks off blockbuster season with the release of Iron Man. I'm Jennifer Collins.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Bartenders have been watering down drinks for as long as there have been bars and people drinking at them. But this week has brought the practice into the cold, hard light of brand identity, thanks in large part to the energy drink Red Bull. The super caffeinated pick-me-up goes for about $2 a can retail. It's become popular in nightclubs, too, where it's often mixed with vodka. Or at least people have been asking for Red Bull and vodka. One Chicago club has been ordered to pay more than $500,000 in damages for trying to pass off a cheaper imitation. From New York, Marketplace's Jill Barshe reports.
That's the sound of authenticity. Red Bull comes only in a can. Company spies in Chicago knew something was up when the drink they ordered came gushing out of a beverage gun. It was actually rival Roaring Lion. Rob Frankel is a branding consultant. He says the courts require companies to monitor their brands.
Even though you have a registered trademark, if you don't police it, you can actually lose it.
Companies are getting more vigilant. Elaine Carey is head of investigations at Control Risks. She says she's doing big business trolling the internet for counterfeits and inspecting supplier factories.
Companies have to be more proactive and send people out into the field. Large corporations that will easily spend, you know, several million dollars in a year to improve their brand protection.
But high-profile suits may not be the answer, branding consultant Frankel says. They could damage Red Bull's popularity. He says the company's better off training customers to insist on the real thing. I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Now that last weekend's NFL draft is done, the hard work starts. Not for the players yet, but for lawyers and agents trying to hammer out multi-million dollar contract details for a bunch of 21-year-olds. Those huge rookie paychecks are the business of sports today. Diana Nyad is here to explain. Hey, Diana.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. But I'm not making anywhere near the money these NFL rookies are making. Remind us how much these guys do make.
Well, the number one pick this year, he's an offensive lineman, Jake Long. And I mean, he's a great player. The Dolphins probably made a great pick. But this guy is going to make $57.5 million over 5 years with a $30 million guarantee signing bonus. It escalates. I mean, Jake Long's contract is very similar to Tom Brady's, who is probably
who's done some things for the Patriots, the number one star in the league.
Why should he be there?
Now, the NFL's never had these rookie salary caps, but other leagues have definitely beaten this problem. The NBA, for sure, right?
The NBA is the model. They learned the hard way, the basketball guys did. In 1994, a superstar player named Glenn Robinson was the number one pick in the draft. He held out the Milwaukee Bucks, held them hostage, basically, to try to get a $100 million contract. He didn't get quite there, but he got $68 million with a bunch guaranteed. And the next year, they said, we're not going to get held hostage again. We're going to put a rookie cap. And so it starts with the number one player and goes down to the number 30 player in their case. And the NFL is looking to see if they can salvage their risk problem by doing the same thing.
In fact, the commissioner, Roger Goodell, said this weekend during the draft he'd really like to look at that.
He'd like to look at it. And as a matter of fact, as a general rule, the NFL Players Association is very strong. They stick by their guys. They don't let negotiations go south on their players. So you would think that they'll never let this happen. Those rookies get the big money. Let them keep getting the money. But in this case, they've been quite criticized, as you know, over recent years of not taking care of their veterans, especially retired players. So if they do something right by the guys who have been breaking down their bodies for years and years for the NFL, I think it might fly.
Which, of course, brings in the life expectancy thing. I mean, NFL players have short careers.
No, it's true. You know, the rookie cap, the way it works in the NBA, it really stretches to 5 years if you count all the options. And then by the sixth year, you can negotiate for the moon if you want. But the NFL players do have a shorter lifespan. So to my mind, maybe a two-year rookie cap would make sense. You know, everybody would benefit.
What about letting the market work, though? I mean, the team owners are willing to pay. Why shouldn't the players take advantage?
Well, I just think it's an unfair market value. You know, it would be, for instance, if you were a kid coming out of law school and you're the star, you're the Harvard star of your class. Okay, great. You're going to be terrific for that law firm. And in a few years, when you really start bringing in the clients and solving the big cases, you know, you're going to be a superstar and make all the money. But if you were a partner in that law firm, do you want to see the rookie come in and make the money you're making? To me, it creates a false market value. Tom Brady is setting the market value. Now, if you've got a rookie, he's the highest paid lineman in the league, and he hasn't played it down yet. It's wrong.
Diana Nyad and the business of sports. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
For most of us, the drive to work is at best a chore. At worst, it's a complete waste of a couple of hours. But at least there's the option. In Saudi Arabia, strict religious laws mean women aren't allowed behind the wheel. So to get around, they have a couple of choices. They get a male relative to give them a ride, or they can hire a driver. There has been talk that women might be able to get licenses within the next couple of years. But in the meanwhile, many women who can't drive can't work either. Kelly McEvers reports.
Hannah Muhammad is a single mom with five children. Four of these children are girls. That means Hannah's family has not one, but two drivers, one to ferry the girls to school and one to take her to work. Not the ideal situation, but Hannah managed until late last year, a problem with her daughter's driver.
He was really very bad driver. He made an accident with my daughter.
So Hannah fired him and gave her driver to her daughters. She was in between jobs at the time. She then applied to bring another driver over from India. This costs thousands of dollars, plus hundreds more each month once he arrives. So much that the driver's salary eats up about a quarter of Hannah's income. And it can take months to process the driver's visa.
Well, it's a big problem for me. I get a job and I said, no, sorry, I can't start now.
So you got a job offer and you had to turn it down?
Yeah, I turned it down because nothing to do. I cannot move now.
I can't.
And now Hannah, who usually works as an executive secretary, is going stir-crazy while she waits for the driver.
I cannot stay like this at home, just watching TV and drinking coffee. It's not my personality at all.
Thing is, Hannah's got it better than a lot of women here. Nurses and teachers cough up half to three-quarters of their income to pay for drivers. This TV show shocked the country late last year by tackling the issues of poor women and women driving. After the main character's father dies, she disguises herself as a man so she can drive a taxi and support the family. We are all one, she sings. Why do men and women have to be separated? That's the message some 3,000 women recently sent in a petition to Saudi King Abdullah, asking him to lift the driving ban. The king is actually seen as a reformer, an image that emerged during his own TV moment.
I'm Barbara Walters, and this is Nightline. Tonight, an exclusive interview with King Abdullah, ruler of Saudi Arabia.
Walters faced off with the king just after he took the throne in 2005.
Would you support allowing a woman to drive?
I believe strongly in the rights of women. I believe the day will come when women drive.
Magazine editor Maha Akil says most Saudis assumed that after the king made this statement, the driving ban would be lifted.
That gave it sort of an official backing. But what is missing now is clear directives that women can drive and can apply for a driver's license.
Religious officials keep delaying the process because they say society's just not ready for women to take to the streets. They say men would go crazy seeing all these women out in public after being segregated for so long. So some lawmakers have proposed special driving hours for women, special lanes, even pink cabs, like they have in neighboring countries like Dubai and Bahrain.
These are cabs driven by women and for women only.
So far, though, there's been no movement on these proposals. And even though organizers of a recent car show made a point to invite women, they told them to bring their drivers, too. In Dammam, Saudi Arabia, I'm Kelly McEvers for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note for you to bear in mind the next time you go through airport security. You still can't take a bottle of water through those checkpoints, but as of today, the Department of Transportation says it's okay to take methanol fuel cells on board with you. The fuel cells aren't actually on the market yet, but manufacturers hope that in the next year or so, you'll be able to use them to power your cell phone. Of course, by then, you'll probably be allowed to make a cell phone call from the plane, too, won't you? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 189 points, 1.5%, closed over 13,000. The Nasdaq rose 67 points, 2.8%. The S&P 500 added 23 points, 1.7%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, Big Pharma pushes off-label drug use.
Anything that we can do to increase physicians' awareness of new science and medicine is a good thing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.